No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote. Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of the district were long overdue.
That was Sweet Honey in the Rock with Give the People the Right to Vote. Hello and welcome to Shadow Politics, an hour-long grassroots talk show, which will attempt to shine a light on the issues that you care about. I'm your host, United States Senator Michael D. Brown, coming to you live from the District of Columbia, America's last colony. Together with Don and Doug and the rest of the people at BBS, we hope our show will start a dialogue with America about the issues that are important to you and affect the lives of all of us. And we have a special guest tonight, an old friend, somebody who was is an amazing person. Her name is Valerie Plam. She is an author. She was a New York Times best-selling author for her memoir, Fair Game, My Life as a Spy, My Betrayal by the White House, which was released as a major motion picture of the same name, starring Sean Penn and Naomi Watts. And it always bugged me, Valerie, who you look like. Now I know you look like Naomi Watts. Along with Sarah Lovett, Valerie has published a well-received, several well-received fictional spy thrillers, Blowback and Burned. And we're so happy to have you on the show tonight. Thanks for being on, Valerie. Welcome.
Thank you for having me, Senator. And that's quite a catchy little tune you have opening up your show.
Yeah,
I'm happy to be here.
Sweet Honey in the Rock. You know, it's hard to go wrong. But so let's start at the beginning, just so everybody has some background on this, because yours was such an amazing story, and everybody. In an effort to be for full disclosure. I'm going to tell you that Valerie and I used to be parishioners with our families at the same church, and we followed every moment of what happened to you with great interest. For one thing, because you were so amazing, such an amazing person at what you did. I mean, when we found out about you, first of all, you were the most unassuming person. You were just the nicest person. If you'd asked any of us, who you were, we would have said, oh, she's a college professor, or she's a nurse practitioner, or, you know. But then all of a sudden we opened Vanity Fair magazine, and there you are with an AK-47. It just blew us away that you were a spy, and you know what? You're exactly what a spy should be, right? You know, somebody that we're all subjected to our own prejudices. You know, we expect all spies to look like Boris and Natasha, but you know, I guess that's not the case. The successful ones probably don't. So why don't you tell us about your experience? You are covert CIA agent, and you were outed in what was a horrible incident of political retaliation for the fact that your then husband, Ambassador Joe Wilson, tried to tell the truth, and the guys on the other side didn't like it. So why don't you briefly explain how that went and how
of
it
course.
Felt?
Well, first of all, thank you so much for having me on, Senator.
Of
what a
course.
Delight. And reconnect after many years, after sitting in the same pew at St. David's.
Yes.
Well, I guess I start by saying I was a covert CIA ops officer. My expertise over time developed into nuclear counterproliferation, which essentially means I worked to make sure that bad guys, whether they were black marketeers or terrorists or rogue nation states, did not get a nuclear weapon, a nuclear capacity. And I loved what I did. I was very proud to serve my country. And it all ended rather suddenly in 2003. And to refresh your listeners' memories, because it was huge at the time, but it's been a minute since that happened, what happened was in July of 2003, July 7th to be exact, my husband, Ambassador Joe Wilson, wrote an op-ed piece for the New York Times entitled What I Did Not Find in Africa. And in it, it was, as they say, an op-ed piece. He wrote that the primary reason that the Bush administration had given the American people to go to war in Iraq was that an imminent nuclear threat was coming from Iraq, Saddam Hussein. If you recall, around the same time, you had Condoleezza Rice and the National Security Advisor saying things like, we don't want to see a mushroom cloud, the smoking gun in the shape of a mushroom cloud. And so Joe wrote in his piece, like, no, this, I know this not to be the case. About a year and a half before, he had gone to Niger at the request of the agency, which I had nothing to do with, but that's another story. I was accused of having sent him to Niger, but that wasn't true. But he had gone at the behest of the Office of the Vice President through the CIA to check out reports of 500 tons of yellowcake uranium going from Niger, one of the poorest countries in the world, to Iraq. And if that had been true, it would have been very alarming because it would have told us that Saddam Hussein was seeking to reconstitute his nuclear program. But Joe checked out these reports and he came back and he reported back to the CIA that these are totally bogus reports, that it did not happen and here's why, da 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 da. So he, you know, tucked that away. He was glad he went pro bono, served pro bono. He was glad he could answer a question asked by the Office of the Vice President. But in January of 2003, in then President Bush's State of the Union address, he talked about a sale of yellowcake uranium from African countries to Iraq. And at that time, Joe heard that, and I heard it, and Joe looked into it, and he was told, you know, very discreetly, look, if, you know, things get in the president's speech all the time. If you want to do anything about it, you'll have to do it yourself. So he pursued this quietly, and it was clear that the administration was pushing this picture that Iraq was building nuclear weapons, and that we, you know, potentially the United States would be harmed. So he wrote this op-ed piece, and it caused a great deal of uproar because at that particular moment in time, the combat operations in Iraq were winding down, but the insurgency, if you recall, the looting of the Baghdad Museum and so forth was happening, and it was basically anarch. It was chaos. No WMD was being found whatsoever. And the administration felt the sting of those words deeply because they were backfooted at that moment. And what happened was a week later, July 14th, 2003, a conservative columnist who's gone now, Robert Novak, wrote a column and he talked about Joe Wilson's piece and sort of said offhandedly, oh, and by the way, his wife, Valerie Plame, works for the CIA and she sent him. So when that happened, when we woke up and Joe saw that in the paper and he came, and we were at that time living in Washington, D.C., he tossed the Post on the bed and he said, well, he did it. Except there were a lot of expletives in there.
Yeah, sure.
A lot. And I knew that my covert career was over. I was done in that instant. And I was thinking about all the assets that I had worked with over the years with the CIA. Of course, I was concerned about my then 3-year-old toddler sleeping in the room next door because or the room next to ours. And that just started truly years of this political scandal that just grew and grew and grew. Within a month or 6 weeks, the CIA had referred the matter to the Department of Justice for investigation. A special counselor was assigned. That was Patrick Fitzgerald. And ultimately what happened was, although there was definitely a conspiracy, the only charges were brought against the Vice President Cheney's chief of staff, Scooter Libby. And Scooter Libby was convicted on 4 out of 5 counts. That was in March 2007. It was just the only way I can liken it to falling down Alice's rabbit hole, where white is black and black is white. We heard about these people, Joe Wilson and Valerie Plame, on TV, on the radio, in the newspapers, and they had nothing to do with who we were and what our characters really were. But it was this just crazy period. And the day after Scooter Libby was convicted, I testified before Congress. And then the day after that, I moved with the rest of my family, my husband and our little kids, to New Mexico, where I am now.
Wow, New Mexico. I mean, you couldn't have picked a better spot. I just want to tell you I'm honored that I worked for an organization that gave me and Bill Richardson an award for our activism at the same time. It was a great honor for me to accept that with the governor. And I also lived on the Taos Pueblo for a while.
Oh, I didn't know that. Yes.
When I was a teenager. So I've got nothing but good things to say about New Mexico. But I've got to tell you, you talk about going down the rabbit hole. Like I say, we all followed what was going on, and we felt the same way. I always, for example, thought, well, what the hell difference does it make if his wife sent him or the government sent him or whoever sent him, if he's telling the truth? What do we even care?
What was happening?
I understand they were trying to discredit him.
Their playbook was to try to make the story not about, how come there's no WMD in Iraq? And we told you that. They tried to make the story about Joe Wilson and Valerie Plame, and anything that would undercut our character or our motivations was, to coin a phrase, fair game. And for, among other things, I was called a glorified secretary. Joe was called a liar and a traitor. They also put forward this idea, this falsehood that I had, you know, nepotism involved there, that somehow I had sent my husband to Niger to find out this story, which is absurd. Anyone who has ever worked for the government knows that there's about 15 people who sign off on your travel orders, and, you know, it's just ridiculous. But they had all the levers of power, and that narrative held for many years of the Bush administration and their supporters. And boy, were they angry with Joe and Valerie.
Yeah. Well, you know, and it's crazy. It just grew and grew and grew. And you know, there are other, not only Scooter Libby, but Richard Armitage. I mean, it's such a complex.
Carl Rove, Judith Miller, Matt Cooper. Oh, there was, quite the lineup.
Yeah, and Carl was a parishioner at St. David's, too. I mean,
isn't that special? You know, I think I took communion with him once. Yeah.
You know, he said, I heard him, I've got to tell you this story. I heard him on the radio say, they said, we understand you go to the same church that Valerie goes to. They said, it's an interview. And he said, yeah, but she goes to the wacky service. Because we went to the children's service, right? So
in terms of today's politics and the level of personal destruction, I mean, it was bad. There were really dark, dark years for Joe and I and our family.
Sure.
But compared to the amplification of social media now and the years of Trump, where you believe it's just I guess if it had to happen, I'm really glad it happened before social media and before the era of Trump, where it's particularly vile.
Wow. And we should tell the rest of the story, which is that punk Scooter Libby got pardoned by Trump when
indeed
Trump,
his sentence was commuted by President Bush.
Right.
So he just wrote a check, and you can be sure it wasn't out of his checkbook. For a fine. So his sentence was commuted, and then Trump pardoned him. Although I'll bet you dollars to donuts that Trump has pretty much no idea who Scooter Libby is. He just was
has
told.
No idea. No. I'd be surprised if Trump has any idea what the situation in the world is these days. I really worry about that. but let me ask you, since it was such a dark time in your life, you turned around and ran for Congress. Why would you want to be part of this mess? I saw that you ran for Congress in New Mexico. You should know, if you haven't seen Valerie Plame's congressional commercial, you should see it, because it is the coolest commercial. You know, it's the coolest.
It is a cool commercial.
It's
as far
cool
as
because
political,
you know,
campaigns go.
I was a campaign consultant for 25 years, and that's the coolest commercial I've ever seen. So
it is.
What motivated you to do that?
Yeah, why? So the seat, I was living at the time in Santa Fe, New Mexico, which is in northern part of New Mexico. The seat became available because then Representative Ben Ray Lujan was running for Senate. The seat became available, which is, since there are only three seats in New Mexico, it doesn't happen often. And I thought, I really want to serve my country again. And I thought, I can do this job. I can do it well. And my home and my heart are in New Mexico. I landed out there because my work on nuclear weapons. I went to Los Alamos quite a bit. So I ran for Congress, and I did it with my heart. And we ran a clean, good integrity-filled campaign.
That was your mistake.
Unlike some of the others. And I have to say, I am so grateful that I did not win, because Congress now is so chaotic and very little can be achieved. Compromise is a bad word. And some of the characters that are in Congress, I mean, this has nothing to do with politics in terms, but they're just wacky people that are performative, and they could care less about governing, and it is about for their own sense of power, I suppose.
Well, let me ask you a question, because you say compromise is a bad word. One thing that really bothers me is that patriotism has become a bad word, and I don't know why that is. It seems to me that it's become a bad word with liberals, and I just don't get it. You know, I grew up in a family where I come from a long line of veterans, including my great 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 grandfather, who was in the Continental Army when he was 17 years old. And my brother, who was an F-111 pilot. I know your dad was an Air Force veteran too. But I believe in patriotism. I believe that America is a great country. And even though I'm a diehard Democrat, I believe what Ronald Reagan said, that with a shining light on the hill. Now, you've been around the world, and I've had enough experience that I've spoken on several continents, and that's still true. We're still a shining beacon to the world. I don't know if it hasn't been diminished over the last several years. I'd hate to see that, but what do you think that is? Do you have any sense of it, living out in New Mexico, where people probably are patriotic?
Well, just like you, I do come from a family of military service. My dad was an Air Force officer. He served in World War II. My brother was a Marine. He served and was wounded in Vietnam. But I started noticing, gosh, at least a decade ago, that the Republicans began claiming the flag as their own. Yeah. And I found that disturbing because clutching the flag, as Trump has literally done, does not make you a patriot. When you put country first, that does. Yes. And I have to note that Liz Cheney, and believe me, most people have reason to be very skeptical of the Cheney family politics. That said, Liz Cheney has shown herself to put country above her party, and I respect her for that. Patriotism doesn't have to be loud. You don't have to put a flag in, you know, on your car and your bumper sticker. I mean, that's all great. That's terrific. But what to me patriotism really means is sometimes releasing what you individually want and doing what is for the good of the country. And yes, there's no question that when we can, this is a whole other conversation, but I think beginning with our invasion of Iraq, our credibility internationally has been eroded. And we find ourselves where we are today. I think the Biden administration has tried mightily to reclaim some of that, but conditions, as they say, conditions on the ground have deteriorated. And to make those strides, there are still possibilities, and I think he and his administration are trying very hard. But it's really, really difficult because across the board in this country, one, we're deeply polarized, but two, our trust in institutions, be it in our politicians and Congress or the military or the church, or even school boards now become, you know, a battleground. People are entrenched and deeply polarized, and our trust in institutions to carry out what their values are, what our shared values are, is highly suspect. And, of course, that has been only put on rocket fuel with disinformation, misinformation, AI, deepfakes, you know, so on and so forth.
Yeah, that's crazy. Well, let me ask you, you've got a conference coming up, which is just, you know, again, it's like in the coolest place, folks. It's in New Mexico, Santa Fe, and it's called Spies, Lies, and Nukes. It sounds like really, really cool. But tell me, what's it about, and who's going to come? I mean, are other spies going to come? And doesn't that blow your cover? Doesn't that blow your cover if you show up?
It's going to be, yes, as you say, Spies, Lies, and Nukes. We're going to hold it at La Fonda Hotel in Santa Fe, New Mexico, November 10th, 11th, and 12th. And I invited my former colleagues from the CIA, and I'm so proud of the speaker lineup I have. There's so many wannabes out there, and I know what these men and women have done. They are highly decorated, deeply respected CIA officers that have really walked the walk. And so we're going to be discussing everything from the hotspots, Russia, Ukraine, Israel, Gaza, China, to how to recruit a spy, the disguises we use. We'll have different panels, CIA in the movies for fun. I have some of the best Middle East experts that are going to be telling us what the heck is going on in Gaza and what we can expect. It is for the general public, but what I'm trying to do is curate it so that we both have both some historical things and interesting stories and peek into the past, as well as connecting the dots to today. And you need to know what you need to know about intelligence and AI and social media and how that's being used in the national security realm. This is our third running, and I would encourage, we're almost sold out. This is not PlumbyCon. It's not a cast of thousands, but we're almost sold out. And for your listeners that might be interested, I think the ticket prices will go up, I want to say, in a few days. I don't know exactly when, but they should go to spieslesnukes.com and check it out. As you noted, Santa Fe is a beautiful place. It always is, but this time of year it's gorgeous. The hotel is lovely. It's right on the Santa Fe Plaza. So I'm very excited to be able to offer this. And the secret is I really just do it for me because I love to have my former colleagues come out. They all love being with each other. So it should be really interesting.
Well, and who doesn't think spies are cool? I mean, we were raised on this stuff. You know, I'm sure you understand that the Spy Museum in Washington, D.C. is one of the most visited museums now in the District of Columbia. In fact, it opened in a pretty small venue and has moved to a much bigger venue.
And, I know.
And it's really hard to get in. I mean, you have to make reservations in advance, and it's very cool. It's very cool.
And particularly now, you can't read the paper without reading about how intelligence is affecting our world, whether it is the surprise attack, horrific attack of October 7th by Hamas, incursions into Israel, whether it's a Chinese spy balloon going over, whether it's
spy balloon.
Putin in Ukraine and his threat of the nuclear threat that he has made. So it's everywhere, and I want my audience to both, of course, be entertained, but also educated and have a better idea when they walk out of how the dots are connected.
Well, I encourage people to go to the website, and if you have the least bit of interest in this, go, because it just sounds so cool. But let me ask you the 800-pound gorilla question. Was what happened, the massacre in Israel, was that a failure on the part of Israeli intelligence? Should they have? I mean, because it didn't look like this was a bunch of guys that just got together and decided to do this.
Oh, no.
They had been planning it for at least
2 years. And of course, Mossad, the Israeli intelligence service, is one of the very best in the world.
Yes.
So, of course, they will be investigating this, but it is intelligence failure of massive proportions, and I have to believe that the internal dissent in Israel over the last few years, they took their eyes off the ball, didn't they? And left them vulnerable, and Hamas, it seems from what I've read, I don't have any inside information on this, but they used very old-fashioned methods of communicating and planning. So despite the very high-tech surveillance that Mossad in Israel is able to deploy in Gaza, the fact is Hamas was below the radar using ancient methods of meeting and communicating and planning that was completely missed. And it is absolutely devastating what is happening as we speak right now. Of course, the incursion into Gaza, and it's just heartbreaking.
Yeah, well, it certainly seems that that's the old adage, is it not, when you study warfare, that you grow strong on what your enemy leaves behind. And it seems that they've done that. And the thing that I find so disturbing about this, besides the great loss of life, is that they certainly should have known what the Israeli response was going to be. They did this knowing, You think they're surprised at the way? Do you think that they're surprised at the way Israel has responded? I mean, when I first saw it, I said, "Oh my God!"
Yeah, I am not a Middle East expert. You'll have to come to the conference to hear my experts talk about this. But I think part of this, it would. I think it's correct to say that Hamas was hoping to provoke this sort of massive retaliation that we're beginning to see now in the hopes of creating a wider conflict. Hezbollah thus far has been sitting on the sidelines up in Lebanon and elsewhere. And this would absolutely be devastating to the entire region if the conflict is allowed to spread.
Yeah, I get that. And you know, I think that I've always found that the single most dangerous person in a society, and this is probably true of governments too, is somebody that feels they have nothing to lose. And it seems like Hamas went at this with the idea that they had nothing to lose, you know, that they knew it was just going to be horrible. Yeah, I just don't get it. And we can't let this spread, can we? And so that brings me to my next question, which is we have two aircraft carriers that we've sent over there, the two battle groups. That's enough firepower. Just an unbelievable amount of firepower. We've already retaliated against the Syrians. We need to take a containment posture over there and continue to, I mean, how do we keep the conflict from spreading? It seems already Iranians are up to their necks in it.
Yeah. Secretary of State Anthony Blinken is definitely doing the shuttle diplomacy that we used to talk about with Kissinger. He put on a lot of miles in the last 10 days. We are doing everything. Obviously there's lots of communication between Netanyahu and President Biden to consider our own reaction after 9/11, and we you know, the billions of dollars and the bloodshed in our reaction to what happened 9/11 has not served us well, and I believe President Biden has cautioned Netanyahu on the same sort of reaction. I don't know that Israel has any sort of plan or strategy for the day after the last Hamas fighter is killed. What then? What then? Is this so horrific that there are those that said, well, the only way we can go ahead is, in fact, through a two-state solution? Or if you hear many in the Israeli cabinet, they have completely taken, you know, that simply isn't palatable to them. The cycle of violence goes on and on. And I just think of the children that have been killed and the hostages that are still in Gaza to be accounted for. It is, you know, there are no words. There are no words.
Well, let me ask you this question, and I don't know that you want to speculate on this or not, but, you know, I grew up in a segregated neighborhood in Newark, New Jersey, Italian neighborhood. An African-American walking through my neighborhood when I was a kid would be taking their life into their own hands. We had a group of vigilantes that ran the neighborhood. And my grandmother would say that they were horrible people, but they kept the neighborhood safe. She tolerated them because she felt they kept the neighborhood safe. Do the Palestinians tolerate Hamas? We talk about them as innocent bystanders, but do they tolerate Hamas? Do they believe in their heart of hearts that Hamas is right?
I can't speak for millions of Palestinians. They are, as we know, Hamas is deeply embedded within the civilian population.
Right.
So it's not easy to be able to just go after the militants. Sure. The Palestinians have not been well represented for years in trying to, form their own sovereign state. Hamas, of course, was voted in, which was a big mistake on our part, but that's another conversation. I think it was in 2007. Mm-hmm. Yep. And just like the Taliban does in Afghanistan, and this is very simplified, but they say to the civilian population, look, we're going to provide you security and food and medicine, and, this is what you got. And because conditions have long deteriorated within Gaza, so convoluted, and the context in which all this is happening is so convoluted. But what Hamas did on October 7th was a massacre of, what they did. And so, I just hope that the United States, in conjunction with their allies in the region, are able to provide, some pathway ahead that is far more peaceful than what we are seeing now.
Well, I think that says a lot about what they expected the reaction to be, that they were really brutal. Again, my childhood in Newark, New Jersey, in an Italian neighborhood that was run by the mob when my parents were kids, that's really the mafia model, right? Whenever they do something, they make it really brutal to send a message. And obviously the brutality that Hamas showed, killing children, babies, and old people. And,
They wanted
it to be particularly brutal. And, mm-hmm. But let's move on, because, yes, you're right. This has been going on for 2,000 years, so we're not going to just solve it on
the show. Solve it in this conversation.
No. Mm-hmm. But how about our intelligence networks? Do you feel that we have a strong intelligence network through the CIA and the other organizations in the United States that are, tasked with keeping us safe?
I do. I do believe, the CIA, there's lots of things they can be criticized for, but they are absolutely one of the premier intelligence services. There are really good people that you never heard of, and they take their lunch to work every day and work at their desk, and they really are working to keep America safe, and there are thousands and thousands of them. And I just hope this is what intelligence is for, to be able to understand, perhaps have some insight to give to our senior policymakers so hopefully they can make wise decisions. As we talked about the intelligence failure, you can be sure that we are in close contact with Mossad, and as we always are, and trying to what happened and how do we fix it and moving ahead.
Well, when you talk about Mossad too, is there a culture that develops, I assume there is, in any agency like the CIA or like Mossad? Wasn't the Israeli intelligence agency formed in response to, aren't they famous for hunting down all the Nazis after the Second World War?
And, they do. I don't know the history of Mossad. They are rigorous, and they do not have some of the constraints that we in the CIA have. I believe, yes, they came out of the Israeli fight for independence in 1948, and Mossad was formed, I believe, shortly thereafter. They are ruthless, and they are very, very good. But when you have internal fighting, as we have seen in Israel over the last 2 to 3 years, if not longer, that weakens your society. Much as I would say here in the United States, our deep polarization makes us vulnerable in ways, for instance, Putin, of course, is just rubbing his hands. No one's talking about Ukraine right now, correct?
Right.
You know,
we're, right.
And then he amplifies it through his disinformation, misinformation of social media to drive deeper wedges, as we have seen ever since October 7th. It is hard for someone to decry innocent deaths without one side or the other saying that's not good enough. And I have to believe that is amplified and further, given more influence by Russia. And why? Because it makes the United States weaker.
Yeah, and, you know, I can't help but, you know, take note of the fact that now we have Republicans on Capitol Hill that are screaming about aid to Israel, which I believe in aid to Israel, especially right now. But they're also talking about backing off Ukraine. They want to back off Ukraine all of a sudden. And that would be a serious mistake, wouldn't it?
It makes my head kind of explode when I came of age during the Cold War, where the Republicans were definitely the hawks,
yes,
and the Russians were bad. And now all of a sudden that has changed. And somehow you have some Republicans, not all, but more than one, talking about how Putin is a victim in all of this, that he was, you know, even though Russia clearly was the aggressor in Ukraine. I believe that we need to support Ukraine. If Russia is allowed to continue with this war without any consequences, then we will have the consequences at our doorstep. So I believe firmly and wholeheartedly in continuing, as they say, lethal and non-lethal aid to the Ukraine. And I know our intelligence services are indeed helping Ukraine, because they are a sovereign nation. Their sense of nationalism has heightened incredibly over the last decade, since Russia took off, chewed a piece of Crimea in 2014. So I think we have to, our commitment to Ukraine has to be steadfast. And unfortunately, the clown car that is now Congress, for 2 weeks, zero got done because the Republicans couldn't figure out who they wanted as Speaker of the House. And it's pretty clear that Trump is still running the table over there, and they are not doing the people's work, to say the least. And this doesn't have to do with politics as much as do your job. I don't know about you, but like, if you didn't work for 2 weeks because you couldn't kind of figure things out, should you be paid? I mean, I just find that absolutely ridiculous.
Well, that's the lovely thing about Congress, is that, you know, they've been talking about the looming, I don't want to digress here, the looming government shutdown if they hadn't gotten things together, you know. We're only funded through the middle of November. But guess what? When nobody else gets paid, when the soldiers don't get paid, when the CIA doesn't get paid, when the people that handle your job security don't get paid, Congress still gets paid.
That's funny how that works.
Yeah,
funny
it's
just how that works.
It's just absolutely incredible how shameless
we're dealing with agents of chaos. They don't want to govern. They don't have solutions. They simply are seeking to sow chaos. They do it very well. Steve Bannon is not a member of Congress, but he's pretty much leading the band.
Well, we can't even get started on Trump. 91.
We won't. I don't want to spend any oxygen.
What do you have to charge this guy with? I mean, what hasn't he done? And it's still to have polls that show him above a guy that spent his entire life in government service and has actually improved the economy and other stuff since he was elected. I mean, it's just crazy to me. I don't understand it. I've been in politics for 40 years, and the only good thing that ever happened from Donald Trump is now nobody in my family asked for my political opinion, because when he first ran, I said, what are you, crazy? Nobody's going to vote for him. Yeah. Nobody will vote for him. I was wrong. We're just so far apart. And that's really the thing, right? The only thing that can bring us back together is our commonality. The fact that we all love our children, the fact that I hope we all love our country, that we, you know, mm-hmm. and the further apart we get and the less we associate with each other, the worse things get. Let me ask you about a realignment. Do you see a realignment in the world between countries like China, India, that crazy man in Venezuela? I know that you spent a lot of your time worrying about whether nuclear weapons were going to crazy people like North Korea and Iran and Syria. Mm-hmm. But what about these major countries who want to become world players, but really aren't quite able to make it, like India? India's got the largest standing army in the world, and I believe they have nuclear weapons as well. You would know that.
Yes, they do. Yeah. And India and Pakistan worries me, because they are both nuclear armed and yet very, frankly, in many ways, unstable countries, increasingly less democratic. Yes, of course, there's a major realignment with the rise of China. They are clearly looking to be a hegemonic power. What's happening in the South Seas? I feel any president, whether it's whoever it is that wakes up and is president, you gotta. Right now, it's Biden, but he has to wake up in the morning and go, oh, you know, because it's the problems are huge. And yes, of course, my passion has been the nuclear threat my entire adult life has been advocating for, this is a really dumb idea we have to destroy ourselves. There's two existential threats. It's either climate change or right. the nuclear threat. And I have focused on the nuclear one. And in fact, at the conference, I'm preparing my presentation now to talk about the change in the global nuclear order. We only have one real standing treaty left. It's the New START treaty with the Russians, and that will expire in 2026. And Putin has already said, no, not so much. The guardrails have come off. Of course, under Trump, we exited the Iran nuclear deal, the JCPOA, or it's called, which is, I believe, was a terrible mistake. And sure enough, I take no happiness in saying, told you so, because Iran is much closer to a nuclear weapon now than they were under the auspices of the so-called Iran nuclear deal.
Yeah, of course they are. And, but that's not, but politics is sowing fear into people. It's not telling people that they're going to be safe. You know, prosperity is right around the corner, but right now, you're in a lot of trouble. That's the mantra of a politician. And what you need to do to end your trouble is to elect me, because I've got all the...
Of course, fear is the greatest motivator there is.
Greatest motivator.
Love is up there, but I think fear motivates people. And whether we see in this country fear that, it's going to be different. We're going to give people who don't look like you and think like you and act like you, we're going to make sure that they're given equal opportunities. Well, a lot of people are scared of that. So it's,
yeah. And then, you know, that was my dad. My dad used to say, love your mother, but fear me. You know? Yeah. And we did. We did fear him. And when we got older, we were like, why did we fear him so much? You know, he never did anything horrible to us, but he convinced us. And that was, that's what politicians do too. They convince you that.
They do it very well. Yes.
Right. They do it very well. And, I am glad that personally that you didn't get elected to Congress, but I'm sure you would have done a great job. But I think you're better serve humanity as the next Arthur Conan Doyle or Ian Fleming or talk about your books. They're doing really well, right?
They did do well. The first one was Blowback. The second one was Burned. The fictional one, Spy Thrillers with Vanessa Pearson. I'm totally due to write a third one, and I just have to get my head around it. I enjoy writing. I'm a voracious reader myself. I want it to be entertaining, but more reality based, not the Hollywood version of what people think spies do. And there's certainly an abundance of stories out there to be told.
I bet there are, and I hope you tell some of them. We're running out of time. And I'd love to have you back sometime and talk after the conference and see how it went and talk to you, because there's so much to talk about. But let me ask you, is there anything you want to say that I haven't asked you, and give another plug too on how people can connect with the conference?
Thank you so much. It's Spies, Lies, and Nukes. The website is spieslesnukes.com. We're almost out of tickets. If any of your listeners are intrigued, take a look at the website. We love feedback as well. And I'm really looking forward to this. This is what a time we're living in. It is crazy making, but the idea is that you come away feeling a little, that you understand a little bit better of what is going on. I appreciate that. And the opportunity to catch up with you after many, many years from me living in Washington has been such a delight.
Well, me too. And I got to tell you, I just received an emergency text message from one of our millions of listeners. This is from my wife, who says, before you sign off, please tell Valerie that I said hi. So
that's so kind.
Well, she remembers you finally, and she remembers your children fondly too. We all do. And we miss you here in Washington. And if you come back, please let me know, because I want you to drive me around. I want you to do that thing you did in the Camaro where you spin 180 degrees. I'm dying to try that. I need somebody to show me. And thanks so much for being on the show. I wish you all the success with your upcoming event. And we'll have you back sometime. I would love to have you back.
Thank you. What a pleasure. And wishing you all the best. And I will let you know. I try to come to Washington, once or twice a year. So
okay,
I'll let you know
great.
When I'm next there.
All right. Please. I'll take you to lunch at the Democratic Club. And now we dedicate a song at the end of every show to our, that's how we play out at the end of the show, to our guests. And I have a very dear friend in Washington named Lisa Rowan, who's here. And she had a friend who wrote a song called Secret Agent Man. So here's from Johnny Rivers. This goes out to Valerie and all those people in the CIA, including several members of my family who I will not name because I don't want to be the next Scooter Libby. So thank you so much, Valerie. And
thank
here's
you, Senator.
Johnny Rivers. We'll see you next week.
There's a man who leads a life of danger. To everyone he meets, he stays a stranger.
Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote. Give the people.